May 2011, Melbourne Mahaprabhu Mandir, and going on with the Prabhupada, the Living Bhagavatam Prasadam seminar. What's Chitralekha doing? She's leaving. When did she come in? So just in transit. She's just in transit. Okay, so we're actually coming near the end of this. We'll probably finish this seminar tonight. That will be the last session. So some looking at eating with non-devotees, which is sometimes a problem when you have family members that expect you to come and, you know, share a meal with them and so many other things. And also, you know, when you're preaching, because you often get, especially in India, you get invited to people's homes. That's one of the ways that they like to, they're not always up to hours, so that poses a little difficulty. So January 4th, 1976, Prabhupada was in Nellore, in South India, and we were on a morning walk. So living in somebody else's house is difficult when the family members are non-Vaishnav. When preaching in India, devotees often are obliged to stay in the homes of life members. Their bad habits are tolerated in order to broadcast the message of Krishna consciousness. However, Tamal Krishna Maharaj told Srila Prabhupada that when Gargamuni Swami returns to India, he doesn't want to do that anymore. Gargamuni had been in charge in Calcutta for several years. Then he had gone back to the West in 1975 with a party of men, and they were collecting for the Mayapur project. So Tamal said he is determined that he will not eat in anyone's home. Prabhupada approved. That is very good. Not only that, but he's not going to sleep in anybody's home either. They want to camp out by the riverside. Oh, very good idea, Prabhupada said. He says that from reading your books, it's very clear that Chaitanya Mahaprabhu was very careful, strict, to only eat prasadam cooked by proper persons. No, Prabhupada said, purchased from the Jagannath temple. So people would come to offer him prasadam. So what is the cost of the prasadam? That was taken, and then he purchased. Formerly, the system was that there was no hotel, but there were temples. So you can go and purchase very cheap price. I went with my father in my childhood in a place. So my father would never take food in anyone's house or in a hotel. He'll find out some temple and pay them and take prasad. Still, there are so many temples. So I was about 10 years old at that time. So say 70 years ago. So he paid 2 annas to the pujari, and he gave us so much. It can be eaten by 5 or 6 men. Khichdi, vegetables, varieties, so much, just for 2 annas. So that was the system. Nowadays it's not. People eat anywhere and everywhere. Restaurants are, of course, a very popular thing. But if you look, there are still many temples that have that system. Just like in Calcutta, there's a Lakshmi Narayan temple just nearby where we live. And every day you can go for lunch or evening meal. You pay a small amount, I think 30 rupees or something nowadays. You get a big plate, as much as you can eat. Yeah, it's very nice. It's all prasad. It's all offered to the deities. So Prabhupada, actually in Chaitanya Charitamrita, he mentions about how careful, you know, Chaitanya Mahaprabhu was and other devotees were in not accepting food from non-devotees. And even people that were well wishers of ISKCON, life members, you know, we were told to be very cautious because they're not exactly up to our standards. As I mentioned the other day with Mr. Sethi in Bombay, he knew what the standards were. Practically he regarded Prabhupada as his guru, but at home he was still eating onions. And somehow or another, you know, I don't know whether they cooked that preparation for Prabhupada in a pot that had been used for cooking onions before, probably. And so even the smell of it was there in the food. So Prabhupada wouldn't eat it just because it smelled of onions. So a more graphic incident of accepting prasadam or food at the home of some life members occurred when we went to Pune in December of 1976. The Malhotra family, very rich family, they have a very big house, and they've been keen ISKCON supporters for a long, long time, right from the early days when we started up in Juhu Beach. So they had invited Prabhupada to come up to their property in Mahabaleshwar, and we flew down to Pune on December 22nd. So the first thing that we did before we set out to go up into the hills was to have breakfast with the Malhotra family. So the house is large with a swimming pool, and they're obviously quite rich. So for breakfast, everyone sat around the table together, and the food was brought in large bowls and simply passed around. Everybody was simply helping themselves, dipping in, eating, and then dipping in again, thus completely contaminating everything. Fortunately, I had served Prabhupada with a portion of everything on his own plate before anybody had a chance to touch it, so he was not affected. I was also careful only to take from the bowls which were untouched. So I thought when they brought everything out on the bowls and they put them, they had this big long table, about 20 people could sit at it. So they brought everything out, put it in the bowls, you know, big serving bowls, put it on the table. So before anybody could sit down and eat, I thought, you know, I'll get a sample of everything and put it on Prabhupada's plate, then it will be offered to Srila Prabhupada and then it will be prasadam. So I did that. Then when we sat down and then I saw their manner of eating, they were simply, you know, dipping in, putting their hands in their mouths, dipping back in the bowls, passing them around. Everybody was chit-chatting and talking loudly. And so I was very happy that I'd gotten a portion of everything, you know, on Prabhupada's plate before they got their hands on it. And I noted which bowls they hadn't touched yet. So I only got my prasadam from there. So anyway, that was breakfast. Then we drove up into the hills, and again, after Prabhupada had got settled in, he had his massage out in the sunshine. The property actually was well situated. It was between Mahabaleshwar and another village called Panchgani. So it was about halfway between. And from the front, not exactly a garden, it was just all grass, but you could see down the mountainside and you could see the whole valley down below for miles and miles. So it was a very beautiful area. And because the weather was nice, then Prabhupada said, alright, let's stay here for at least 3 days, because his health was not good at that time at all. And you know, going up into the hills, it was a 3-hour drive. And, you know, going up a mountainside, so it was all like a switchback. Every 100 meters or 200 meters, you had to do a complete double back on the road. And that way it was going up. And I saw Prabhupada became quite physically discomforted from the drive. It really caused him problems, just the constant switching back and forth on the road. So, you know, he was naturally glad when we finally got up to the top. And because it was so nice, then Prabhupada said, all right, let's stay for 3 days, although the plan had been that we would just go up for the 1 day and then return the next day. So then after Prabhupada had had his massage and bathed, then they again, the family again, cooked. So lunch was the same as breakfast. Different food, but the same style of eating. So this time I made sure that Prabhupada and myself had sufficient so that no seconds would be required. And Giriraj and Gopal Krishna were also careful to do the same thing. We didn't want to offend our hosts, but we wanted to keep to our standards. However, it was still difficult to sit all around one small table because the gross habits and lusty propensities are all openly displayed when it comes to the matter of satisfying the tongue. It was hardly prasad savor. So it wasn't, you know, it wasn't Prabhupada's mode of eating. Mostly Prabhupada liked to sit alone, and many times, you know, he would sit with his small table, his chonky, against the wall, and Prabhupada would sit facing the wall and have his plate like that, and he would eat very quietly. So to sit there with the whole family all laughing and joking and grabbing, you know, filling their mouths up, it was quite difficult. But Prabhupada tolerated it because they were, you know, our members. So then in the afternoon, the family went off to Mahabaleshwar. It was, I remember the weather was, you know, the clouds came in because it was December. So in the late afternoon, a heavy kind of mist settled in. It was quite wet. So Prabhupada stayed back at the house. What is that you're doing? Don't do that. Very distracting. Prabhupada stayed back at the house. Most of the family went into Mahabaleshwar, except for the younger brother, who was a follower of Rajneesh. So he kind of hung back. So Prabhupada called him over, and then he sat him down and preached to him for about an hour. Gradually, you know, he kind of first of all extracted from him what his ideas were, and then he very carefully led him into, you know, the real version according to Bhagavad Gita. So by the end of it, the man admitted that actually Rajneesh was just a cheater. Yeah, that he wasn't giving any real knowledge at all. And Prabhupada was very happy with that. So this man got a lot of mercy. I mean, you know, Prabhupada called him over and sat him down and preached to him. So then the family arrived back in the early evening. And after some light conversation, we were again obliged to sit and eat with them. So they laid out some quite heavy foodstuffs, and we took a full meal before retiring for the night. So this was about, you know, 7 o'clock, 8 o'clock. And Prabhupada was too polite to say anything. But after everybody had taken rest, he called in Giriraj and myself and told us to prepare to leave at first light. So although in the afternoon he said we'll stay for 3 days, when he realized what that meant, you know, the house wasn't big, it was small. It was a little bungalow. And there were 3 rooms off of a corridor. So myself and Giriraj and Gopal and Haridas were in the first room. And then Prabhupada was in the middle room. And then the family, they kind of crammed themselves all in this back room. So after everybody had taken rest, Prabhupada called me back in. He said, actually, we can't stay here. We should go. So he said, you get ready to leave first light. He was having difficulty digesting the food and his system was upset. Also, he was not keen to associate so closely with them. He told us to inform them as soon as we wake that we are very sorry, but Srila Prabhupada is not well and we have to leave, so we won't be able to stay after all. So in this way, he said, we can leave in a friendly manner and not upset them. So December the 23rd, the next morning, began with the ring of Prabhupada's bell. It was 5 a.m. and we were all still sound asleep. Giriraj and Gopal Krishna didn't even hear the bell. And I only responded because I was trained to hear for it. So that was part of being Prabhupada's servant. You know, you were on call 24 hours a day. And even when you were asleep, you know, somehow or another, your brain was tuned into the bell. Because Prabhupada did ring sometimes in the middle of the night. A graphic example of that was when we were in Tehran in August, the first night that we were there, because we arrived really late. Then when we got to the house, it was like about 11 o'clock at night. And then Prabhupada, you know, spent an hour or so talking with the Treya Rishi and a couple of others. And so it was after midnight before everybody took rest. I'd set up Prabhupada's dictaphone, and then I had to give him his massage. So it might have been 12:30, 1 o'clock by the time I, you know, went into the room next door and got into my sleeping bag. As soon as I laid down, the bell went. We had an electrical bell, you know, with a buzzer attached by wires on Prabhupada's desk, and the bell was right next to my head. So I jumped up and I ran in and offered my obeisances, and Prabhupada was kind of flicking the switch on the dictaphone. It wasn't working properly. So he said, just fix it. So I kind of played around with it. It was like a faulty connection, loose connection. So I got it working. So then I went back and took rest. I just laid down. I'm just drifting off to sleep. The bell goes again. I go back in. Same problem. I fixed it. I went back. I'm just laying in my sleeping bag, drifting off to sleep. The bell goes again. So like this, five times. Yeah, I'm just, every time, I'm just going off to sleep and the bell goes again. And I'm running in and out. So then, after the fifth time again, I was just dozing off, you know, drifting off to sleep. So I jumped up again, sixth time. I went into Prabhupada's room, I offered my obeisances. And Prabhupada's there, everything's working, he's translating. And after I, you know, I looked up, he looked at me, you know, it didn't say anything, but it was like, what are you doing here? So the sixth time I dreamt that the bell had gone off. I was so, you know, so kind of on edge. So, you know, that was the mood. You had to be, even when you were asleep, you had to be, you know, tuned into the bell. So anyway, I heard the bell. So I jumped groggily up from the bed and went in to find Srila Prabhupada sitting at the end of his bed with a small table on which I had set up his dictaphone in front of him, illuminated by a small table lamp. He looked at me when I came in and he asked quite innocently, "So, you have all become infected like this?" So in the background there was a loud snoring coming from the Malhotra's bedroom. And still thick in the brain from a heavy sleep, and not realizing what Prabhupada was implying, I said, puzzled, "Well, I don't think that we're as infected as all that." So without losing his demeanor, Prabhupada said softly, "No, I mean to say that you should have risen at 4 a.m. and bathed and had Mangal Arati. But due to only one night's association, you were already infected." I could understand then his point that association with karmis, no matter how friendly, is so dangerous. He told me this was simply due to eating with the karmis. The eating process is so important. So he sent me back into our room to wake the others and bathe. And by first light, we were ready for off. Fortunately, the Malhotras were not long in waking, and after some short discussion, they agreed to allow Srila Prabhupada to use their car to drive back to Bombay, as it was said to be shorter than driving to Pune to catch the flight. So Pune was on the south side of the mountains, Bombay was on the north, and from the top you could go down either side. So if we'd have gone back down to Pune to get a flight back, then, you know, it would have been 3 hours down that way, then the airport. And then, of course, the other thing, it was also a fact that Prabhupada didn't want to return to Pune because it would have meant having to take breakfast with the family again at their house. So, you know, Prabhupada just wanted to get back to Bombay as quickly as possible. So after tactfully taking our leave, we all drove down to the village, and Prabhupada had a short walk with them around a small lake before we set off for Bombay proper at 7:45 a.m. It wasn't long before we hit some very twisty sections of road, and although it was all downhill progress, it was slow and difficult. for 1.5 hours continuously without any break. We negotiated one sharp S-bend after another, every 50 to 100 yards. Prabhupada was in great discomfort, and after a half hour, we had to suddenly stop the car, and Prabhupada vomited out the open door. As we pulled up, I got into great anxiety because I realized that I had not packed any water, and now it would be required for Prabhupada to wash his mouth and hands with. As I wondered what to do, by Krishna's mercy, a car suddenly appeared behind us. It was the only vehicle that we had seen in either direction for the whole time that we were on the road. And then just as, you know, we had this problem, this car suddenly appeared. So they immediately pulled up, and they gladly supplied some fresh water for Srila Prabhupada. So after a couple of minutes, we were on our way again. But again, after another half hour, Prabhupada was vomiting. Finally, we arrived on the flatlands, and Prabhupada vowed that he would never make such a journey again. It's one of the very few times that I ever saw Prabhupada in real physical distress, you know, just from the car going back and forth like that. It really caused a lot of problems for him. So after about an hour, Prabhupada had us stop at a village. Now feeling a little better, he decided to have some puffed rice. So he told us to go to the different stalls and bring back samples until he saw some that he thought was fresh enough. So we were running here and there, bringing back little batches. Prabhupada was trying it, and then he picked out the batch that he thought was the best. He took a little, and then he passed his remnants to us as we drove along. I was a little surprised that he was eating again so soon after throwing up. But Prabhupada smiled, and he said that puff rice can be eaten at any time, even if one is ill. It is so innocent. So, again, Prabhupada's use of English, it's so innocent. Yeah. So after a very difficult ride, we arrived back in Bombay at 2:15 p.m. So it was a good 6 hours to get there. As usual, the devotees were ready with a full arati and foot washing paraphernalia in his room. But I saw that he was a little dismayed when he came into his room, although he didn't say anything. So that was one of the things about being in Bombay. At least at that temple, they were always very, you know, keen to offer Prabhupada Guru Puja when, as soon as he arrived. He would go up into his quarters and they would have a full Guru Puja. Everybody would crowd in. They would wash his feet, give him garlands, etc. So, again, they were doing that, but I could see that, you know, there was just a slight look on Prabhupada's face which indicated to me that he really, it was going to be a real strain for him to go through it. But he didn't say anything. He didn't want to refuse his disciples' offering of love and devotion, but it was going to be a strain. I therefore ushered everybody out before they could begin, despite one or two protests. So I decided, you know, to take the initiative, and I just picked up the arati tray just before they started. I handed it to one of the devotees, and then I started gently herding everybody out, and I'm saying, "I'm sorry, Prabhupada's very tired, and you can do this some other time." So a couple of them got a bit agitated, but Prabhupada didn't say anything. So because he didn't object, then I understood he was happy that I was doing that. So everybody left, and then immediately Prabhupada said, "All right, give me my massage." So we went out onto the small veranda outside his bedroom, and as I began to massage him, he made this comment. He said, "I was punished also almost immediately for eating with the Kamis." So that was his punchline. "I was punished almost immediately for eating with the Kamis." I couldn't imagine Krishna punishing Prabhupada for anything, but that was his humility. So that again drove home the point that how careful you have to be whose company that you're eating with. So that was in December. A couple of months later, we were back in Calcutta. This was on February the 5th. And at that time, because we had the same temple, we've always had the same temple in Calcutta 3 Albert Road. But in those days, you know, it was a small place, there wasn't much facility, and it was very difficult, very austere, and especially for the ladies. So we had a couple of women, Narayani Mataji, I think, was one, and Shruti Rupa occasionally was staying there. And there really wasn't any decent facility for them. So they had made an arrangement with one of our big life members, Mr. C.L. Bajoria, to stay in a house next to theirs. So, you know, they were rich people. They had a big house. And then there was some, you know, separate quarters for the servants. And so some space there. So they had, you know, offered that the ladies could stay at their house. So this morning, Prabhupada was invited to the house of Mr. C.L. Bajoria, who is a very rich life member. He has a very large, well-kept house and grounds, but he is very tight with his money, as are most rich men. I don't think that I'll probably put that in the book, but I haven't written this up yet. This is in the next volume, or the last volume. So he has a number of our women staying at with his family because there is no facility at the temple for them. And so as Prabhupada entered his house, he met him with a pranam, and standing in the midst of 3 or 4 of our ladies, he jokingly said, "Welcome to the ISKCON women's department." And we all left. Prabhupada remained for about half an hour, and then after taking a little prasadam, then he returned back to the temple. As soon as he got back, he called for the temple president, Abhiram Prabhu. He wanted to know why our women were staying at the man's house. As soon as he made that remark, he said, even though it was joking, "I could understand that their presence is an imposition. Otherwise, why would he make such a comment?" Prabhupada immediately picked it up, the psychology. He told him that to have the women staying there was not correct, and we should not take advantage of his offer like that. "They are inviting from a sense of etiquette," he said. "But if we actually go and live there, then it becomes a great burden for them. These rich men, they keep a big house to avoid cramping. So then to always have guests is difficult for them." So apart from this, he said that it was also a bad advertisement for us, and he advised him to get a flat for any extra devotees that come. He also objected on the grounds that it is bad for the consciousness of the devotees to live in such opulent surroundings. He quoted Bhagavad Gita 2:44, "Bhogaishvarya prashaktanam taya parita chetasam." In the minds of those who are too attached to sense enjoyment and material opulence, and who are bewildered by such things, the resolute determination of devotional service to the Supreme Lord does not take place. Prabhupada said, "Women especially are prone to an easy life. They do not like to pass you, and if there's a chance for an easy life, they'll take it, and then all spiritual life will be finished. It is very dangerous to live in such opulent surroundings, and to eat the food of a Vishayi is very polluting. And when the mind becomes polluted, then disaster." He therefore told him to make immediate arrangements without any delay for them to move out. But he said they should do it in such a way that the man should be told that, "Now we have found a suitable place to stay. We thank you very much for your kind hospitality, and now we will live in our own quarters." So in this way, Prabhupada said, he will not feel that we are suddenly leaving his place for no reason. Prabhupada is very expert in all of his dealings with the common man, so that they may not get a bad impression of the devotees of the Lord. So that was it. They rented a flat, and all the ladies were moved into there. So again, pertinent lessons. Prabhupada was very, you know, sensitive about the image that the devotees were creating, and especially amongst, you know, the rich class. People sometimes, you know, make promises or offers out of a feeling of obligation. Now, that doesn't mean that everything should be taken advantage of. We have to be very careful to see that, you know, it maintains the proper devotional standards And also, you know, the proper mood of preaching. That preaching means we're giving, not taking. Yeah? If the mood of a preacher becomes, you know, that they go and preach thinking that I'll gain this or I'll gain that, you know, I'll get some advantage in somewhere or another, then it becomes a business. And then it's not preaching anymore and it's not devotional service. Okay, so other instructions on devotees not taking prasadam cooked by karmis. February the 7th, this is 2 days after the Bhujuria incident. This is a year before. This is 1976 in Mayapur. During his massage, Prabhupada received a letter from Balavanta Das, the temple president in Atlanta, in which he heard that the devotees were making tea from tulsi leaves. As soon as Prabhupada heard that, he said, immediately stop it. He was very disturbed by this news, and he declared that such tea should not even be made for Lord Jagannath during his yearly convalescence. So the devotees got the idea after the tulsi leaves had been offered, and they're not, you know, not unoffered once, but offered tulsi, that afterwards then they make it into a tea. Prabhupada was very disturbed. Immediately he stopped it, because he was well known for not liking the tea drinking mentality. That was what was the final straw in his marriage. It ended his marriage when his wife sold his bhagavatams in exchange for tea and biscuits. Prabhupada told me that when I was in Hawaii. I was giving him his massage one night, and he was just laying there, and then he started laughing for apparently no reason. And then he said, you know my story? So I said, your story, Srila Prabhupada? He said, yes, how I left home. So I said, no, Srila Prabhupada. Actually, I had heard it, but I wanted to hear it from Prabhupada. And so he told me, he said, tea on me. He said, my wife, he said, she was fond of drinking tea. So, and she would, you know, Prabhupada would tell her to stop and she wouldn't do it. So one time he came home and she'd actually swapped his bhagavatams for, you know, some tea biscuits and tea. So he got very angry and he told her, he said, right, he said, this is it. He said, now you have to choose. Either you choose your husband or you choose your tea, but you can't have both. So she said, all right. He said, she thought I was joking. So she said, all right, then I'll have my tea. So he said, that was it. He said, sometime afterwards, I left home. I borrowed 10 rupees from a friend, and I never came back. That was it. So Prabhupada was not, you know, a fan of tea drinking. And especially not using tulsi. Nowadays I see there's some product that's being sold even in ISKCON temples, tulsi tea, yeah, or tulsi medicine, tulsi this, tulsi that. It's all offensive. You cannot make tulsi deva your servant, yeah, or try to utilize it for your own purposes, even as a medicine or anything else, not to speak about tea drinking. So, you know, the point is that tulsi deva should be worshipped and served, not the other way around. So Balavanta also questioned whether the devotees on traveling Sankirtan could eat bread that has been made by karmis. Because he was saying sometimes they go out for days at a time. They can't keep prasadam with them for so long, so what to do? So Prabhupada replied that they may not, unless it's in an emergency situation. In any event, he said that such food cannot be offered to the deities. As a substitute, he suggested that they eat farina, fried in a little ghee with sugar added, or puris, because these would last for at least 3 or 4 days. So he gave some alternatives, but not buying karmi grains, as they say, or karmi bread. Okay, so a little later on, same month, February, this was the 19th, another incident in Mayapur. Because the weather has become quite hot, some visiting devotees are buying flavored ice on sticks from the stalls in front of the temple. So some kids are out there selling ice lollies. Jayapataka Swami asked Srila Prabhupada if we could make our own iced sherbet drink for the Gopurnima festival. He's afraid that the devotees will become ill from the local confection because it's generally made from bad water. Prabhupada was disturbed to hear that the devotees were going outside to eat. He quite emphatically said, "No one should buy anything made in the market. If they eat these things, they will fall down. Nobody should eat anything not offered to the deities." So he was really, you know, strong about it. So that word went out to all the devotees. Whoever was going out, stopped buying things from outside. And actually, just on that point about the contaminated water, I had, myself and many other devotees, we had practical experience about, you know, eating local confections when we first went to India. In the 70s, when we were first getting set up, there was not very good facilities. I mean, nowadays you go, there's filtered water, there's, you know, nice comfortable rooms to stay in, etc. But when we first went there, there was very little facility. And most devotees, almost without exception, got, you know, severe bouts of dysentery. And the first time I went was 75. And I remember being on my back for about 8 days with dysentery, passing stool about 6 or 8 times every day, you know, uncontrollably. Samendranath went there. He had it for about 18 days. He came back like a skeleton. We actually, at one point, we thought he was going to die. So, you know, it was all from just eating, you know, outside. And I particularly remember what gave me my dysentery. I had gone out the front gate. There was a little kid with one of these boxes around his shoulder, an ice box, you know, with lumps of ice inside, and he had some homemade ice lollies. And I knew I shouldn't have eaten them, but I was just hot and I was feeling a little lusty, and I thought, you know, the heck with it, I'm going to have some. So I bought 2. And I swear, as it was going down my gullet, I could feel the little germs inside going, "Hey, Harry Ball," you know. I could feel it. Within a half hour, I was already sick. I got stomach ache. I couldn't hardly walk. I felt winded. And then immediately, only it was like instantaneous, I got punished immediately. So, anyway, Prabhupada was very concerned about that. So that was on February the 19th. 2 weeks later, March the 8th, most of the devotees had arrived for the festival. And, of course, I was friends with most of the Australian devotees that came. And I heard that some of them had been purchasing fruit from the market. So I remembered Prabhupada's previous comment that nobody should eat anything without first offering it to the deities. So then I asked Srila Prabhupada if they should stop. But Prabhupada wasn't disturbed. He said, "Fruit may be offered within the mind." So, a refinement, you know. Although he said, "Don't buy anything from the market, you'll fall down." But when he heard it was fruit, he said, "Well, that can be offered within the mind. It doesn't have to be actually offered directly to the deities." Okay, so only qualified persons may prepare prasadam. So this was a letter that Prabhupada wrote to Gopal Krishna. The Delhi temple in early 1976 was at Bengali markets. It was in a horrible little place. And then we lost the lease for that because there were complaints from the neighbours. And finally they moved into a new place at Lajpat Nagar 3, which was a much better facility. It was like a semi-detached house. It had a small lawn outside, which there were, you know, with like these what they call French windows, glass doors that opened out onto it, and we were able to put a shamayana over that, and immediately many people started coming, so it became quite popular very rapidly. And Gopal Krishna, at that time he was Adhikari, he sent a letter to Prabhupada reporting on the new facility. So this was on July the 11th in 1976. Prabhupada was in New York. So Gopal had a question about local women cooking. He said, a few of the women who come are strict Vaishnavas at home. They have offered to cook for the devotees in our kitchen. Is this okay? So Prabhupada replied his letter at length. He was glad to hear that many people are being attracted in Delhi, and he told him to keep up the standard of deity worship very high. He was negative in his reply about the local women cooking. Unless one is initiated, they cannot cook. They must be regular disciples, then they can do deity worship. So there is no question of outsiders cooking in the New Delhi temple. So that's something to remember, because you have lots of congregational people, they want to cook. But unless they're initiated, you cannot offer such things to the deities. And you have to be very strict about that. Yeah. I see sometimes in our temples, they allow practically anybody to come in out of some sentiment and cook something, and then it's offered to the deity. But it should never be allowed. You have to be second initiated to do that. Although there was an exception that Prabhupada made in the Delhi temple again, and that was when we were at the Bengali markets. There were so few devotees there, about six, I think, or seven. So they were quite overwhelmed. They had a full deity program. They had Radha Paratasarati were installed, and there was only Omkar and his wife that were available to do the deity worship. And so Prabhupada allowed them to purchase sweets from the local Bengali sweet shop, which was just on the corner. So Prabhupada knew the owners of that shop, and he knew that the ingredients that they were using were pure. So he allowed our devotees to buy the sweets for the Mangalarati offerings. But that was, again, an adjustment for the preaching, because there were so few devotees there. Otherwise, you can't just whimsically decide that, anything can be offered by anybody at any time. They have to be actually up to the standard. So that's most of everything on eating. Of course, another facet of eating is not eating. That's the other side of the coin. Fasting. So fasting is also one of our principles. As much as taking prasadam is, not taking prasadam is also one of the principles. So a few things about fasting. December 1975, Prabhupada was in Vrindavan. I had just come on Prabhupada's party at that time. I'd probably been on the party about 2 days. And during the morning walk, Akshayananda Swami told Srila Prabhupada about a retired gentleman who wants to come and live in our ashram. The man is very respectful and even offers his obeisances to the sannyasis, he said. So Prabhupada replied, if a sannyasi is not offered respect, the punishment is that the person must fast for the day. That is the Shastric injunction. So Bhagavad Ashraya asked, well, what is the punishment if one doesn't do the fast? Then Prabhupada said simply, then you go to hell. So if you see a sannyasi, you have to offer your respects. If you don't do that, you have to fast. If you don't fast, you go to hell. Ekadasi fasting, of course. Generally, Prabhupada set a fairly low standard to facilitate the preaching work again, because his disciples were going out every day, selling books, working very hard, preaching in different ways. So Prabhupada gave us a basic standard for observing Ekadasi. No grains, no beans, and no peas. There are actually other standards. Of course, we've all seen that Ekadasi book. There's so many different things that you can do, staying up all night, chanting, etc., etc. So December the 28th, 1975, we were in Sanand, Gujarat. Again, we were staying with, they weren't life members, but it was the royal family in that area. We were staying in their house. So they were doing some cooking that we were taking, And of course Prabhupada was taking his regular fare that Harikesh was cooking. So the 28th was a codicil, and we observed a half day fast. So we just decided not to take breakfast at all because it was a codicil. And Prabhupada was happy with that, and he said actually to please Krishna we could fast completely, even from water. Because there is a Nirjala codicil every June. That's coming up, I think, maybe the next Ekadasi, yeah? Is it, Nirjal? So, Prabhupada said, if you want to please Krishna, then you can fast completely, even from water. But the fast also, for us, was welcome for another reason. The meals that are cooked for us by our hosts are swimming in ghee. So they were giving us the usual thing, you know, rice and chapatis and dal and... But they were also giving a pot of, you know, ghee and pouring that on the rice, so it was like swimming in it. So it was nice to have a break. another Ekadasi fast, January the 13th, this was 1976 in Calcutta, so this was the next Ekadasi. Yeah, that one was in the end of December, this was early January. So because it was Ekadasi, we skipped breakfast and fasted until noon. But at lunchtime, the devotees inadvertently broke the Ekadasi because the cook had accidentally put peas into the vegetables. Nobody had noticed until it was too late. So they'd all sat down on the veranda there at the Calcutta temple. They started eating, and then Tamal Krishna Maharaj suddenly noticed there's peas in the vegetable. So I had been massaging Srila Prabhupada, and I was late coming for the lunch. So fortunately I arrived late for lunch because I've been massaging Prabhupada. Just as I was about to eat, Jayapataka Maharaj shouted, "Stop!" So although initially becoming annoyed at being told not to eat, I was relieved when he pointed out the peas. So I was the only one that didn't break the Ekadasi, apart from Srila Prabhupada, of course. So shamefaced, Tamal Krishna Maharaj went to Srila Prabhupada to report what had happened and to find out what should be done. Prabhupada was very angry. He told us we were all nonsense. He angrily rebuked us. "Now you have to fast for 3 days." So this shocked everyone. You know, we were all surprised, and then Prabhupada repeated it and said, "Yes, this is the procedure." Seeing the stunned look on our faces, he relented. But he said that we should observe Ekadasi for the rest of the day and then do the whole fast again tomorrow on the Dwadasi. So that was Prabhupada's standard. Because Dwadasi is the break fast, but Prabhupada told us if you break your Ekadasi, then you must observe it again on the next day. First of all, observe it for the rest of the day, but then do the thing properly again on the next day. So that was in Calcutta. The following month, we were in Mayapur. And then, again, it was Ekadasi. This was February the 11th. Then there was some discussion about how to observe it, because it was a special Ekadasi. It was coupled with a half-day fast for Lord Varahadev's appearance, although the Lord's appearance was actually the following day on the Dwadasi. So to avoid fasting on the Dwadasi, the fast is observed on the Ekadasi. As well as it being Ekadasi fasting, it's also a half-day fast for the Lord's appearance day. So as Prabhupada took his morning walk, he had Jayapataka Maharaj confirm the observance procedure by reading out from the Gaudiya Panjika, which is a yearly Vaishnav almanac that the Gaudiya Math produces. So all the different auspicious times and days and practices are all written there. So since the auspicious appearance of Lord Varaha falls on the Dwadasi, which is the day for breaking the Ekadasi fast, the two are thus combined. Prabhupada said that it would be sufficient to celebrate Lord Varahadev's appearance by singing the appropriate verse, which is describing him from the Song of the Ten Avatars. Prabhupada also verbally listed the proper fasting periods to observe for other auspicious days. So there was a little you know, the devotees were asking, well, what, how should we observe, you know, the different appearance days? So Prabhupada said that Lord Nityananda's, Sri Advaita's, Lord Balaram's, and Srimati Radharani's appearance days are all half-day fasts. Lord Nisringadev's and Lord Ramachandra's appearances are full-day fasts until sunset, while Gopunima is a fast until the moonrise. Tamal Krishna Maharaj inquired about observing the appearance and disappearance days of great Vaishnavas. He described how we observe a half-day fast for our immediate predecessor Acharyas, and he wanted to know if we should do the same for personalities like Narottam Das Thakur and others like him. So Prabhupada said, yes, if it's possible. But he added, if the devotees are engaged in preaching work, then they may not. He said that the main thing is to sing some songs of praise and perform kirtan. So that was again an adjustment. You can fast if you like, but if you're out preaching, then you know that fasting can be avoided. Chanting, it also came up in reference to chanting extra rounds. You know, the standard is 16, but on Akadasis we always used to chant 25 rounds. And at least on two occasions, Tamal Krishna Maharaj asked Prabhupada whether chanting 25 rounds on Akadasi was compulsory. And Prabhupada said, yes, Akadasi means that, fasting and chanting. But then when he was pressed a little bit, what about our men that are going out on book distribution? Then Prabhupada said, no, for that, then you can avoid these things, fasting and extra chanting. Preaching, then you know you have to keep your strength up and do your business. But otherwise, he said, this is for those who are not preaching, who are simply living in the temples. Then they should fast and they should chant more. Okay, so another appearance day that we blew. This was the appearance day of Lord Balaram. This was August 10th, 1976. And we were in Tehran. Somehow or another, we, although Pradyumna was with us, and he was our, Prabhupada used to call him Panditji, he was our Sanskrit professor. So he was supposed to know all these things, but somehow or another, nobody had a Vaishnava calendar. And although today is the appearance day of Lord Baladev, we all broke the fast because nobody checked the calendar until it was too late. Prabhupada wasn't happy about it, but he didn't react too strongly. He simply told us to observe it the next day. So because there was, you know, just this small group, it was difficult circumstances, just three household couples, one sannyasi and one brahmachari. They're in Tehran, very difficult place to preach. Prabhupada didn't make a big thing about it. He just said, all right, well, just do it tomorrow. So then August the 11th, everybody observed the belated fast for Lord Balaram's appearance and held a small feast in the afternoon. Prabhupada took his regular meals though. His health is always bad, and even to miss one meal is very detrimental to his body. So that was difficult for Prabhupada. He was not well. We were in, you know, a high altitude place. I don't know how many meters above the sea that Tehran is, but it's up in the mountains there. And as soon as we arrived there, Prabhupada had uremia, you know, from his kidneys, high blood pressure, so he had a lot of physical problems there because of the altitude. So anyway, that was early August, and then about a week and a half later, we were back in India, and we flew down to Hyderabad for the opening of the temple there. And that was on Janmashtami Day. So August the 18th, 1976. Today is Krishna Janmashtami. We are fasting all day until midnight. Surprisingly, considering his weak condition, Prabhupada said that he would also observe the whole fast. He has also contracted a slight case of dysentery since his arrival here. So in the late evening, Prabhupada asked Palika to cook Ekadasi Prasadam. She served it to him around 10:45 p.m. So we were all amazed that he had managed to complete the whole fast. Just before he took rest at 11:15 p.m., it began to pour with rain. Watching this from his window as the heavens opened up, Prabhupada smiled contentedly and said that this was an auspicious sign that everything had been a success. So Prabhupada saw that it was raining, and then he said, this is because of our, you know, Jagya, opening the temple and installing the deities. I have a little story about that in about Fiji as well, which I'll tell in a minute. So it was difficult for Prabhupada to rest, however, because of the noise coming from the huge crowd that had gathered for the midnight arati. As it turned out, the arati wasn't actually held until 12:40 a.m., so it was a bit delayed. It's supposed to be a midnight arati. But everybody waited patiently and stayed on for the feast afterwards. So then, of course, the next day, August the 19th, that was Prabhupada's appearance day. So we all observed our half-day fast. But, of course, Srila Prabhupada didn't fast on his own appearance day. So today is Sri Vyasa Pooja Day, the 80th birthday anniversary of Srila Prabhupada. We are all fasting for a half day, but unfortunately, Srila Prabhupada is also practically having to fast. He has bad digestion and is coughing up a lot of mucus. So he only had a very small amount of fruit for breakfast and simply khichdi and yogurt for his lunch. So, you know, naturally, Palika was there, Arundhati was there, there were other cooks, and they all wanted, Tejas was there, Tejas wasn't, sorry, the others were. So everybody wanted to cook, you know, a big feast for Srila Prabhupada and offer that to him. But Prabhupada was sick, so all he could eat was just some khichdi and a little yogurt, so that was a bit disappointing. Okay, so mentioned there that he had, on Janmashtami, Prabhupada had Palika cook an Ekadasi Prasad breakfast. Because that's become a big debate. Every now and again you see it breaks out on the internet. You know, people adamantly, you know, arguing that all the fast days, they have to be, you know, the fasts have to be broken only with the Ekadasi Prasadam. And then others saying, no, you know, there's one or two, you know, festivals where that's so, but the rest, it's just a regular grain feast, you know, and it rages on. People quote different, you know, shastras and according to their position. Anyway, so March the 16th, 1976, was Gopunima Day in Mayapur. Prabhupada was there, of course. There was about 500 or 600 devotees from the West that had come for the festival. So attendance at our temple for the Gopunima Day was phenomenal. Estimates of the number of pilgrims entering the front gate ranged between 9,000 to 25,000 people an hour, depending on the time of the day. So this was really the first big festival in Mayapur in terms of pilgrims. I think they estimated about 1 lakh of people came through the gates during the, you know, the whole day. So the flow continued for well over 7 hours. Most of the visitors saw the picture exhibit as well as the temple. Prabhupada had the BBT bring over photographs, or he had different temples bring photographs of their temples and their deities, and then they mounted them in frames. And they'd built this kind of temporary walk-around pandal on the banks of the pukur that was just inside the front gate. That later on, of course, that's become part of Prabhupada's Pushpa Samadhi. In those days, it was just, you know, a big pukur with some raised-up banks. So on the raised banks, Prabhupada had some bamboo put, and then they had sections for each temple, and they put photographs of their deities and preaching and temples as an advertisement to show people, you know, that ISKCON was a worldwide preaching movement. So people were going through that and then visiting the temple, because the temple in those days was very small. It was the ground floor of the Lotus building. That you know, conch building and all that stuff that was built later on. So the road from the front gate to the temple was so packed it became nearly impossible to walk. The local police reported there were people coming from all over Bengal simply to see our ISKCON temple. Many devotees were selling copies of the Gita Gan, and mass distribution of Halava Prasadam went on throughout the day. So that was Prabhupada's special request. He called the GBC in and he asked them, what prasadam are you going to distribute for the pilgrims? Everybody that comes must get something. So somebody actually had suggested some kind of sweet, but Prabhupada said no, puddies and halava. He said at least halava. So that was what was distributed to the pilgrims, because we fasted. But again, you know, that thing of Ekadasi Prasadam or not. We did break the fast with Ekadasi Prasadam, but the general public, Prabhupada and halava, distributed. So the beautiful moon rose at 6:20 p.m. Brilliant and full in the sky, bathed the countryside in its cooling, luminescent rays, symbolizing the transcendental appearance of the Lord and the fulfillment of his mission. Prabhupada broke his fast, taking prasadam at 7:45 p.m. The grounds and temple were mobbed with pilgrims. It was virtually impossible to go down into the temple room, and the narrow road to the front gate was jammed with tens of thousands of Vaishnavas. At one point, Prabhupada sent me out to see how many visitors had come, and he was very, very happy to hear of the large crowds. Typically, he wanted assurance that prasadam was being distributed to everyone. I think there's another section on the following Gopurnima for 1977 that will come up. So August the 22nd, 1976 in Hyderabad, Prabhupada cited an example of somebody fasting. He was giving a darshan, and they were talking about Lord Ramachandra. So Prabhupada was saying about attachment. He said there's one example, attachment for the Lord. There's one example of a brahmana. So he was daily seeing Lord Ramachandra, and then he was breaking his fast. So Ramachandra was out of his station for some royal business. So this brahmana did not take even water for 7 days. Because he couldn't see Lord Ram, he wouldn't eat. So when Ramachandra returned, Lakshman informed Lord Ramachandra, "Here is your devotee, my lord. Because you were absent for 7 days and he could not see you, therefore he did not take even water." Ramachandra appreciated his devotion. So before Lord Ramachandra, there was a Sitaram deity worshipped in the family of Dasarath Maharaj's family. So that deity was kept in the room of Lord Ramachandra because Lord Ramachandra was personally present. So they previously, before Lord Ram's appearance, they were worshipping a deity of him, yeah, in Dasarath's family. Then when he actually appeared in the family, the deity was kept, you know, in some room because he was personally present. So there was no need to worship the deity. Oh, sorry. Got my Skype still working. So he advised Lakshman, "You give this brahmana this deity." And he advised the brahmana, "So you worship this deity, and when I am not in the station, your worshipping the deity is as good as worshipping me." So in that way, the brahmana wanted to fast if he couldn't see Lord Ram. Lord Ram didn't want him to, you know, fast, so he gave him the deity, and then there would be no need. So the next Gopurnima, 1977, there'd been some talk about fasting. Prabhupada at that time was quite sick, very sick actually. When we had been in Bhubaneswar earlier in the month, there was some talk about, you know, special diets. I think I mentioned that before. Prabhupada had been advised by Gargamuni, maybe you could just try, you know, some dried fruits and nuts, that would help. So it came to Gopurnima. And Gagamuni told Srila Prabhupada that he always found it a little difficult to observe the fasts. So Prabhupada told him, no, then you can take some fruit and milk. So he said that will still be considered as observing the fast. So for people that have difficulty, real difficulty, actually I think it's in the Hari Bhakti Vilas, that if you take some milk or some fruit, that's not considered to break the fast. Yeah? Uh-huh. Right. Nartaki's saying that Prabhupada also told Jadarani, because she always was thin and frail and not good health, that if she had difficulty, then she shouldn't fast. So there are exemptions from fasting, because if you're in normal health, you're expected to fast. But sometimes if it's difficult or if you're ill, then you can break the fast and there's not any reaction. And there's also, I think in the Hari Bhakti Vilas, it says that before 8 and after 80, then there's no requirement for fasting. So small children and old persons, not required. But between 8 and 80, then you're expected, unless you're ill. If you're ill, then that's another thing. So October the 4th, 1976 in Vrindavan, there was a discussion about engaging devotees in service, so this principle about being sick. Of course, we've just said there that if you're sick, then you shouldn't fast. But sometimes when you're sick, you should fast. Depends on what the occasion is. Hansaduta told Prabhupada that the preoccupation of many Western devotees seemed to be simply how to maintain their bodies. There's a whole discussion going on about management and sometimes how difficult it was getting the devotees out to go and do their service. So, of course, for the Western devotees coming into India, was often problematic. Adjusting to India was difficult, he said, and many get sick. At the same time, he added, they don't control their eating habits, and so they get into a cycle of overeating and then becoming diseased. So this is one of our biggest problems, he said. Just like you say, when someone gets sick, he should fast. So I tell them, stop eating. You'll get well immediately. If you have a fever, don't eat. Take water and lemon, and then in a few days you'll be all right. So they haven't realized how their own body is functioning, and so they insist on still eating. And then they get sicker and sicker, and they complicate things. I've seen so many people get incredibly complicated digestive diseases, and then they can't work. They get jaundice, they get dysentery, amoebic dysentery, boils. All these things come from taking too much food. And then they want to change their diet. Although they change their diet, they eat so much of the changed diet that it has no effect. And then they require money for medicine. I've spent so much money on medicine. And then, now I have stopped it, I tell them, first you fast for 3 days, and if you don't get better, then I'll give you some money for the medicine. But they're constantly running to this hospital, getting this pill and that pill. All these pills are useless. The real problem is just overeating. And of course, when they overeat, then they want to sleep, because India is hot. And then when they sleep, then they get dysentery. And when they get dysentery, then they can't engage. And in this way, they run into this cycle, which is very difficult to break. So Hansaduta was a temple manager. That was his practical experience. Only very few devotees are able to maintain themselves in India for any length of time. I see a nice strong man comes, and I look at him, and I see him eat, and I think, within a week, this man's going to be sick. And sure enough, he is sick. He's lying down, he's got fever, he's got dysentery, he's going to the hospital. So in this way, we have so many people like that. So that was a pretty good description of what was going on in the 1970s. A wry smile appeared on Prabhupada's face. I have seen. Some of them eat so much, I am surprised. he sat back and he looked at his leaders. So, how to manage this? It is very difficult. Young men. So, October the 4th, fasting for Karatik. So, this was the beginning of the Karatik month. In those days, in ISKCON at least, Karatik was not such a big deal. Those devotees that were living in Vrindavan, because, you know, in Vrindavan it is a big festival, the whole Karatik period. So a few of our devotees were starting to get into it, but it was not like a really big thing, at least in the rest of the society. Anyway, I'd been told that, you know, you should do some special brat for the Karatik, and then you're supposed to get, we knew you get 1,000 times the benefit for the service that you do during Karatik than you do at any other time of the year. And of course in Vrindavan it was said that if you do service in Vrindavan you get 1,000 times the benefit than the same service performed elsewhere. So, you know, Karatik is like 1,000 times 1,000 times. In other words, you know, it's a very auspicious time to be doing service in Vrindavan. So I thought, alright, I'll do a special fast. So I decided during Karatik that I would eat only once a day, and on Ekadasi I would observe a complete fast. I also chanted 32 rounds today. Unfortunately, when I came to doing Prabhupada's massage this evening, I was so weak that after about 25 minutes I had to stop, and Prabhupada sent me to take rest. So for practical reasons, I've abandoned the idea and I'll carry on with my normal schedule. So, you know, that's the point, is that these things are all right as long as they enhance your service. But if you fast or chant extra and that actually is to the detriment of you doing your service, then what's the point? Then better to do your service and continue as normal. So you have to be practical. On May the 30th, 1977, this was after I left Prabhupada's party. Again, something about fasting. Prabhupada had just returned to Vrindavan because he was extremely ill at that time. He had been in Rishikesh and then they had to suddenly rush back from Rishikesh to Vrindavan. And then they called all the GBCs to come to Vrindavan. So this was on May the 30th. I actually had just been made a GBC the month before, in April. Prabhupada had sent me back to Australia. And he had pointed me the GBC here. And then, somehow or another, because I was out on traveling Sankirtan, I didn't get the message that all the GBCs had been called to Vrindavan in late May. So I kind of got it a few days late. And I arrived on the 29th, and by that time a lot of the discussions had already taken place and some of the GBCs were already leaving to go back to their zones. And at least the immediate crisis that Srila Prabhupada was in seemed to kind of abate a little bit, and he seemed to kind of gather up a little bit of strength. So anyway, once I'd arrived, and I decided, well, you know, I've spent so much money, I'm going to spend a couple of weeks here with Srila Prabhupada before I go back. So on the 30th, I had been, you know, asked to be with Prabhupada for, you know, a certain shift. We had a 24-hour shift system going, so at least two or three servants were with him at all times. So in late May of 1977, not long after I'd been appointed GBC for the South Seas, a message came all the GBCs should go immediately to Vrindavan, where Prabhupada had suddenly returned after becoming ill in Rishikesh. It seemed that his departure was imminent. I got the message late, and I arrived on the 29th, a day or two after most of the other GBCs, and by that time the immediate crisis seemed to have abated. Many GBCs were already leaving to return to their preaching fields. I decided to remain for a week or two, not wanting to waste the airfare. And of course, I wanted to be with Prabhupada. Devotees were taking in shifts to stay with Srila Prabhupada. One evening, shortly after my arrival, I was sitting on the ground next to Srila Prabhupada, who was lying on a cot up on the back section of the roof in his quarters. So Prabhupada was lying down. He glanced over at me and he said, "So, in Australia you were reducing?" So I wasn't quite sure what Prabhupada was referring to. So puzzled, I replied, "Reducing, Srila Prabhupada? Yes, in Australia you were reducing?" Then I understood his question. I had lost weight since he'd seen me. You know, I left the party in March. I'd lost weight, and he had immediately noticed it, and he was concerned. So I explained, "Well, I had malaria when I got back to Australia, so I lost some weight. But I'm also only eating once a day now." So Prabhupada was concerned. He looked at me, he said, "No." He said, "If you're hungry, you must eat." So I explained, "Well, I read in the Srimad Bhagavatam that if one is serious about spiritual life, then he only eats once a day." "Oh, then it is all right." So as soon as I had a Shastric reason for doing it, then Prabhupada said, "All right, then that's fine." He didn't like us doing things just whimsically. Yeah. So I was only eating once a day. I was trying to be a little serious. And, you know, Prabhupada saw I'd become skinny. So, "Oh, what's going on?" You know. But then when he heard there was a good reason for it, okay, no problem. Alright, so this is it, I think, the last entry. So let's finish this up. Alright, prasadam is conscious. It's spiritual, it's not material. And there's a difference between the spiritual energy and the material energy, and the difference is that everything spiritual is fully conscious. So this came up in a discussion in Mayapur on March the 4th, 1976. I was having a bit of a debate with Achyutananda Swami. Achyutananda was well known. He was a bit of a genius in various ways, super sharp, extremely intelligent person. Brilliant orator. He could give wonderful classes, and he was a brilliant musician and like that. So we were having a debate during the evening as the temple room reverberated with thunderous Sunda Arati Kirtan. Achyutananda Swami, Pushta Krishna Swami, and myself had a debate on the balcony about whether everything in the material creation is actually spiritual or not. Achyutananda Swami, a witty, brilliant speaker, argued that everything is not spirit, at least not in the sense that spiritual means everything is conscious. Thinking that everything made of matter is conscious, he said, could lead to madness. You know, if you think everything is conscious, you might walk around on tiptoes, not wishing to hurt the floor, or you might hesitate to close a door, not wishing to hurt the door. So in this way, Maharaj spoke quite convincingly that matter is not spirit. Later, I went in to see Srila Prabhupada to get a proper understanding. When I put the question to him, he immediately cited the Srimad Bhagavatam 1.5.20. He had me read out the verse aloud. "The Supreme Personality of Godhead is Himself this cosmos, and still He is aloof from it. From Him only has this cosmic manifestation emanated. In Him it rests, and unto Him it enters after annihilation. Your good self knows all about this. I have only given a synopsis." The Prabhupada immediately had the right verse for the question. He then explained that everything is spirit, and everything is conscious. The material energy is conscious, but it is undeveloped. It can develop consciousness by Krishna's will. Prasadam is matter, but it changes into spirit, and therefore it is conscious. He gave me an example that he used a few days previously, how the body produces skin and nails. One is sensitive, and the other is insensitive. Cut one, the skin, and you'll feel the pain. Cut the other, and you'll feel nothing. And yet your body as a whole is conscious. So he said that the universe is Krishna's body, and thus it is conscious. Jivas, the individual souls, a very minute consciousness, but then there is what he called mass consciousness. If you touch a stone, it is conscious, yet unconscious or undeveloped. So the term matter simply indicates the state of one of Krishna's eternal spiritual potencies. So it was a very nice answer. Yeah. So be careful when you deal with prasadam. It's Krishna. Okay, that's it. That was the last entry. We have now completed the prasadam seminar on Srila Prabhupada, the living Bhagavatam. Srila Prabhupada ki jai. Any quick questions? Chandra Shankar Prabhu. There's a general rule and then there's exceptions. There's always exceptions to every rule, and it requires experience and, as I mentioned the other day, a little intelligence to know when you can make such exceptions. If there's a need, a genuine need, then sometimes you can, let's say, violate these general principles, like not eating in a restaurant. But if there's nowhere else that you can eat and you don't have anything with you, and you have no prospect of eating, until the next day or a few days, then obviously you have to take prasadam where you can. But if you can make arrangements, where you can cook or a devotee can cook and you can offer that to the deities, then obviously there's no need to, take prasadam in a restaurant. Why would you do that? And in the Chaitanya Charitamrita, Prabhupada advises there that one should not eat in restaurants. In conversations he says that. But in some circumstances you may not have any choice, and so you have to do it. And like when Prabhupada was, that sometimes devotees cite the example that when Prabhupada was traveling on the train, they had programs, in the early days, like 71, they were having programs all over the place in Gorakhpur and Surat and many other places. And when they went through some railway station, Prabhupada had one of the devotees jump out and buy him some samosas and bring them back, and he ate them. So, in some circumstances, even Prabhupada was doing that. But when I was with him, he never ever accepted anything that wasn't cooked, by his own devotees. Because by that time, there was no need to. But in the early days, there was no opportunity to eat. So when the appetite comes up, it must be fed. So it requires a little experience. And you have to just be, Krishna conscious. Yeah, if somebody's Krishna conscious, then... actually Krishna conscious. Then whatever they do, that's for the pleasure of the Lord. So even though to an outsider it may appear to be, a violation even of some basic principle, but it may not apply to an advanced devotee. I give the example of Anand Brahmachari, Prabhupada's godbrother. The devotees were wondering, why is he cooking and then he takes some sample and then he goes off and eats? He was cooking in the deity kitchen. So they asked Prabhupada, and Prabhupada said everything that he cooks is automatically offered to his Guru Maharaj. He was Bhaktisiddhanta's personal cook. So, it's a different realm. There are different levels of principles according to... It's like dharma, duty. There are different levels according to whether you're a sudra, a vaishya, a kshatriya, or a brahman. And even beyond that, in the levels of devotional service, if you're a kanista, a majima, or a mahabhagwat, then there's different things and standards that apply. But the best thing is to think of yourself always as being a neophyte, and therefore you have to strictly follow. Mahatma Prabhu. Yes, are we on tonight? I mean, we were supposed to do last night, I thought, and then in the daytime they told me, no, there's not no program in the night, so I'm not sure whether there's a program tonight or not. Can somebody tell me? There is a program. You're absolutely sure? You're not mentally speculating? Okay, so it's been announced. All right, so there is a program tonight. There may be... I have to check my ticket. I'm flying to Perth tomorrow. There may be a Bagwatam class in the morning. But definitely tonight, anyway. We'll have another session. We finished the prasadam, so we'll have a look at another topic tonight. Or maybe we'll just have a questions and answers session, anything that you like, to do with Srila Prabhupada. Okay, so thank you all very much. Srila Prabhupada, Ki Jai.